Welcome. That was a little loud. Welcome to another episode of the Thereafter podcast. I have no idea.
Court. It's
what?
Welcome.
Ooh.
You gotta say it like that. Like, welcome.
That's a totally different vibe. That's a totally different energy. That makes me feel like we're about to do a guided meditation.
Welcome. That's not a bad idea.
To another episode of the Thereafter podcast with your host, Cortland Coffey. And Josh, and
that's me.
We are here applying to be NPR broadcasters for your daily drive. Now just settle in to a comfortable position, maybe sitting, maybe standing, maybe lying down.
Anyway, I have no idea what episode this is. I'm so fucking off my schedule. We were just talking
early
before
20s.
We started recording. We're in the early 20s?
Maybe this is 20.
It might be. I feel like the last one we did was 17, but that maybe this is 19. Anywho, we should have done the research ahead of time. It'll have a number on it when we put it out. It's way late. We're supposed to record this intro and outro for this episode. We've had this interview done for a couple weeks, eagerly anticipating its release, but we never recorded this little part that needed to go with it.
Because Cortland does not have a no button.
No button. It's because I'm an Enneagram 7. I can blame the Enneagram, right? That's how it works, right?
That's what I do all the time.
Yeah, when you have your Enneagram number, it's just a get-out-of-jail-free card for all your bad habits. All Enneagram loving listeners, please feel free to send your hate mail
exactly
to hosts at thereafterpodcast or thereafterpod.com.
You don't understand that this is just who I am.
Because functionally, that is 100% not how the Enneagram works. But anyway, yeah, no, it's my schedule has been nuts. I did want to talk for a second about, you know, because we, you know, it's become a theme for me to talk about Dirty Rotten Church Kids every episode. I had the most incredible.
What kind of kids?
The Dirty Rotten Church Kids.
The Dirty Rotten type?
The bad apples that spoil the whole bunch.
Yeah.
I have been a bad apple on their Patreon for a few months. I actually found my Patreon birthday. It was December 18th. I was thinking about calling it my unborn again birthday. But I thought that might be triggering for people. What are we doing? What are you laughing at?
The day I joined a Patreon.
That's the day I joined the Patreon. It was a big day in my life.
And you called it birthday.
I met awesome. So many cool people. And this last weekend, I spent some time with 20, I think we never counted. It was like people were coming into town and some people were leaving, people were coming in. So I think that there was total like 26 or 27 of us from all over the country who came into Colorado and hung out for 5 days. And wow, it was cool. It's just really cool.
Kudos to you. I mean,
yeah.
But it was exhausting. Anxiety a little bit.
No, it's really like that's my safe space. It's like rooms full of strangers. And there are people
full of strangers taking and consuming things from strangers.
Uh-huh. Yep. These are a few of my favorite things. It was so good. It was so good to just connect. So many people who listen to this, I'm sure you have had the experience. I've met so many people online throughout this last year of COVID and being primarily online for all my social interactions. So, you know, really for the first time in my whole life, I've connected with people and met friends on the internet in a way I never really have before. And we joked that it's like pretty much everything they told us not to do with the internet when we were kids. They're like, don't give out your personal information. Don't meet people in real life that you meet online. It could be dangerous. And we're like, let's rent an Airbnb and all stay there together. But yeah, it was really good. It was a really good time. So
I haven't been doing that part, but I've been meeting new people online And one of these new people is our next guest, Peter Fenton.
Ooh,
man,
yes.
Man, I love talking with Peter.
Yeah, me too. Peter became a Twitter friend, is now a Clubhouse friend. We've had, I think we're connected on Instagram, Facebook. We're pretty much kindred internet family now. And yeah, Peter has an incredible, this was one of my favorite interviews. I say that, I know, every interview, but it was really, really good. His energy is incredible and he's so talented. He's a multi-genre author. He's a screenwriter. He's a playwright. He has just released a book called Abandon All Hope, which we talk about a little bit in the episode. He has a story that honestly kind of scared me. We'll get into it a little bit. Why, in terms of the fact that like his peer group, being a parent and having a kid and trying to kind of like, you know, teach, you know, progressive ideas to my kiddo. He was in a similar situation and even though his parents were not, you know, they were pretty progressive and pretty, you know, embraced who he was, it was his peer group that kind of influenced him to be, right. You know, kind of repressed and to deny parts of himself. And so it's just, a thing where it has made me think a lot about how, I, you know, interact with my kiddo and make sure that he knows that he's got full love and support and acceptance from us as parents. Mm-hmm. Because it's multiple people I've talked to now who say, yeah, my parents were really accepting, but I never felt accepted by my peer group or, you know, society or school or that sort of thing. And it's tough. It's tough, as a parent, because you want to like, you know, your opinion doesn't matter as much as, you know, peers.
My daughter's going into middle school, and I think one of my least favorite things to hear sometimes, like a big fear, is the moment when my daughter doesn't want to talk to me about anything. Because it hurts, and you're like, we have this relationship that is like, you want it to be the best.
And also
open communication.
I am not the smartest cookie in the cookie jar, but I guarantee I'm probably going to give better advice than most middle school peers. But you realize, you know, your parents and your dad, you know, so your opinion is going to be weighted in that way as a child goes through middle school. I remember my parents definitely did not value their opinions in middle school. So let's get into the episode, get into the interview with Peter Fenton. I hope you fall in love with him like we did. And, you know, on the top, let's just say, we'll say this at the end, after you listen, go buy his book, go follow him on Twitter, and Instagram and wherever, so that you can, keep all of his projects kind of in your purview and be in the loop with what he's doing. Welcome to another episode of Their After Podcast. Your host, Cortland, here, along with my co-host, Josh.
Hey, yo.
And today, our guest, Peter Fenton. Peter, say hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Dude, what is up, Peter?
I made the decision to record this interview at midnight here in Philly. So
yeah.
I am living on the edge. It's great. Living the dream.
Yeah. And we're going to see what happens. It's 10 PM for us, but I'm typically up at like 5 in the morning. So this is like midnight for me.
Night is young, Portland.
so yeah, we'll definitely see, but I will definitely not be waking up at 5 tomorrow. So
yeah,
I plan to sleep in, till at least 7.
Have you been outside, Cortland?
Yeah. It's snowing.
Snowing. Really?
Yeah, it is snowing.
Oh my gosh. Like,
give me a break.
This is mid-May.
It is mid-May and it is snowing. Yeah. I mean, it is Colorado, but also climate change is real.
Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah.
This is not normal. You know, we'll see. I don't think it'll stick. So hopefully we'll wake up tomorrow and it'll be sunny and nice, but I don't know. That may be wishful thinking.
Yeah. We can always pray about it.
Yeah, we can. We can do that. It's worked so well for me in so many other areas.
Right.
So, Peter, you and I met. We were just talking on Twitter.
Yes.
And you are a author. You're a screenwriter. Tell us a little bit more about you, and then we'll go back, and I want you to tell us a little bit about your past.
Sure, 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 sure. So jumping in right now where I am in this moment of my life, I am in my mid-20s. As I said, I am living in Philly, and I consider myself an adventurous multi-genre author and screenwriter, and I am passionate about stimulating critical thought and laughter. So I like to do this through clever, self-aware stories. So that is sort of the branding spiel that I have been giving myself lately. Yeah. And so that's where I'm at right now. I've written one film that's been produced, one film that, like, we have the screenplay all ready to go. We just haven't made it yet. And then I've published two books with a small independent press, and I've written two other plays. So just kind
that's of great.
Doing the thing.
That's incredible. Like,
that's
like,
awesome.
That is, if you could have asked anybody what they want to have done by the time they're your age, most people would say half of that. So that's pretty impressive.
Well,
I'd say you're doing well. So yeah, take us back a little bit and tell us, you know, kind of a little bit where you came from, possibly as much as you're comfortable sharing with kind of like how you grew up as it relates to faith and religion. That's kind of like, we like to get a little origin story, a little backstory to help kind of like lay the groundwork for the rest of the interview. You know, how did you grow up? Where'd you come from? What's your story?
Yeah. So I mean, as like any good testimony starts, I grew up in a Christian home.
And good Christian home. Absolutely.
Yeah. I just always, that's how it starts every time. But I did. I grew up in a Christian home in rural Pennsylvania, in Lancaster County, which is spelled like it should be pronounced Lancaster, but it is pronounced Lancaster. And we know you're not from there if you pronounce it any other way.
Yeah, that's never how I would have pronounced it.
Yeah. So my family is truly wonderful. It's actually kind of an interesting situation where my parents and my family were like really progressive people. Like, they're not from the area in Lancaster. My mom grew up there, but my dad grew up outside Philly, and my mom ended up not living most of her childhood in Lancaster, but they ended up moving back to the area. And so where we found ourselves, so like Lancaster County is like the land of Amish people and Mennonites.
Wow.
So like, it's like really Jesus-y where we grew up. And my parents were Christian, but like not super weird Christian, if that makes sense. Like my dad's only brother is gay, and he came out in the mid 80s, and like he's been a loved member of our family the entire time. So like that's always been sort of there in my life as like, oh, God made some people gay. Cool. Including myself, but we'll get to that. But so that was just always kind of like the way that my parents raised me was like, hey, God is real, but like, it's not super weird and not super rigid. And some people do some things and some people do other things, but the community that we lived in was very hard and fast, like conservative evangelical, men do this, women do this. And this is as it should be, thus saith the Lord. And everything can be pointed to at the Bible at face value. So the really interesting thing that happened with my growing up years was that I was spending all this time with people, with kids who were growing up in hardcore evangelicalism. And so I wanted to be like those kids. And so I started adopting, as we got into like middle school, high school, these hardline conservative evangelical views that my parents were kind of like, this is a foreign concept to them. But I was like, no, I'm a real Christian because I believe these things. And I read John Eldridge, Wild at Heart. Like, this is what a man is. I'm going to be that man. I'm a strong biblical man.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Wild.
Yeah. So it's wild. Like, it feels like a reverse of the typical ex-evangelical story.
Yeah. Right?
Because, like, none of this was brought on by my parents. It was all the community that I grew up in and, like, wanting to fit into the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 You're, it's like, that is, like, honestly my nightmare. And, many, like, ex-evangelical, ex-Christian, post-Christian, progressive friends of mine who also have young kids. This has been a topic that we have talked about, is like, yeah, what happens when my, you know, son comes home and he's like, I'm a Republican and I hate trans people. And I'm like, what would I do? Like that, I don't like it. I don't know. It would drive me insane. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I kind of like, in you telling that story, I feel for your parents.
Yeah.
To some extent, but that's so, it's so wild that, you know, that cultural influence on kids, it doesn't really matter what type of cultural influence, it's real and, yeah, and influential in a kid's life.
Oh, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like it, like, I mean, not to go like too Brené Brown, let me dump all my secrets on you. but like looking back on my middle school years, when the other boys in the phys ed locker room had identified me as gay before I was willing to accept that part of myself. I didn't even really know what it meant, really. The pervasive idea that being gay was bad in the society I was living in ran counter to what my parents had told me all my life. And so I bought into what society was telling me. It was just in the opposite direction that it tends to be.
So yeah. I'm curious to know, like, what your parents were when they saw this happening with you. Were they, what were they like? What were they going through? Were like, oh no.
Well, so along the way, and I mean, my mom and I have talked about this after I ended up coming out. She said she took what I said at face value. And so I insisted that I wasn't gay. And so that's what she went with. And that's what the story was for 10 years before I finally came out. It was that I'm not gay, even though other people seem to think that I am. Because like my whole line of thinking, as these other boys were bullying me in middle school, that like their line of thinking was, Peter's different from us, therefore he's gay, therefore let's treat him like shit. And, oh, sorry, can I curse?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Hell yeah. Go for it.
And so
say sacrilegious things, whatever. It's right, all allowed.
Right. I kind of forgot. That was something I wanted to ask before we
hopped. We usually do go over that. Usually I give the disclaimer. Yeah. It's like, say anything that you want. If you say something you regret saying, it's fine to say I cut that out. So
cause, well, great.
Which is all, that's the standard rules. Cause I will say wild and ridiculous things. And sometimes I go, yeah, I don't think I want that in the episode. So yeah. All allowed.
So anyway, so their whole MO was, Peter's different from us, therefore he's worthless, therefore he's gay. Like, and the thinking that seeped into my head was, if I'm gay, then that means the assholes were right. And that was a scary thing. So like I made it my mission in high school and into the beginning of college to prove them wrong, which I mean, after a while, it's like I'm proving these 12-year-olds wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, how much of that for you was conscious, and how much of it did you feel was subconscious in terms of that repression or that, you know, not feeling like you were your full self? I think that there's two different narratives I oftentimes hear from people, is like, I didn't even really allow myself to ever think about who myself was.
Yeah.
And then I hear other people who are like, I knew who I was and I just could not, you know, say it.
Oh, you were spot on with that first description. It was like, okay, it had just not even crossed my mind that it was a possibility. It was like, yeah, I know that they are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So categorically. And so like at first it probably was conscious that like I had to prove that I wasn't gay. But then over time, like it became a subconscious thing. That like once you get to like 7, 8, 9, 10 years after the fact that I'm still dealing with it, it was totally unconscious by that point. Like, mm-hmm. I think over time it sort of, it was conscious, but then it kind of seeped into me.
Yeah.
In such a way that like, you don't even realize it, but it becomes such a part of your thinking and your understanding of yourself that, yeah, there's this like, I forget what the name of the model is or something, but you go from like conscious incompetence to, or you go from unconscious incompetence, like you don't know what you don't know, to conscious incompetence, you don't know, or you do know that you don't know.
Mm.
And then you go to conscious competence, I know that I know. And then eventually it goes to unconscious competence.
Mm.
I don't really know that I know, but I know.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. 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 That's I mean, I've never heard that model explained like that, but yeah, that feels similar to things that I've experienced.
Yeah.
For sure.
And so like, I think we go through this on a number of different levels when we're learning anything, but I think the learned like behavior management of being straight, for the listener at home, I'm using air quotes. I went through that to the point where I was unconsciously competent at completely avoiding myself.
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I lived as a shell of myself in early to late college.
So, let's talk about, so in middle school and then high school, becoming more like the community around you, what did that manifest out for you?
Well, let me tell you about summer camp.
Let's talk about summer camp. I love it.
So now, I mean, as with everything, I think that there is good and bad you can take from every life experience you go through, every decision you make. Like, I do think that there's, it's not all bad when I talk about summer camp. And I want to underscore that to any former coworkers who might be listening or any of that sort of thing. Yeah, my relationship with summer camp just completely fucked me up. I was a camp counselor for 4 summers, 4 consecutive summers. And I don't think camp was a bad thing. But I think what I made it in my life, an idol, if you will, to use good Christian terminology. Mm-hmm. Basically, I saw this camp community, this camp staff community, as like the first place that I really felt accepted. It's like, I mean, in hindsight, that's hilarious. But it was like the first time where my quirkiness, my just like, not being like other boys, again, using air quotes for the listener at home, I just felt embraced as like, you are weird, but your weirdness makes you good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah. And so that was magical to be affirmed that way for the first time in my life in a community other than my own family. It's like my family was always good, but it was just like when you're 16, 17 years old, you don't appreciate that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so to find this group of people who loved Jesus and also loved me, it was just like, this fits. This feels great. The problem was, like, when you're working for a summer camp, the aim of summer camp is to create a great experience for the kids that are under your care. I do still believe that. Like, I think that camp is wonderful when you're a kid. I think that it is unequivocally great. And I mean, there's some problematic stuff with like the altar calls and whatever, whatever, but like, you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's good. But it became all about the experience that I had for myself. And like, I became this camp persona. And talking to my parents about it after the fact, they said it really felt like you had joined a cult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We love Jim and Beth. They're great. It was like this attitude that I had, this ultimate devotion that I had to this community of camp staff was just like, just otherworldly. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was a place where I felt loved and embraced, and I felt like I was doing good. And I probably was doing good in spite of all of this. But it was just like, it destroyed relationships that I had, like with my parents. I remember the night of my high school graduation, like we had started our pre-camp training for the summer. And so I had basically had to be dragged back to my high school graduation ceremony, kicking and screaming, because I just wanted to be at camp. And like, I only heard about this after the fact, but apparently my parents were going to have some kind of like after the ceremony, like, I don't know, like refreshments or whatever. They had that all set up back at the house. I just bolted after the ceremony and I drove right back to camp. Mm-hmm. I was like, for what?
Yeah.
Yeah. What you have, yeah. Man. So in Cortland, in our days, like we had those times where, you know, we wrote off everybody, you know, off old friends. We wrote off our parents, because at the end of the day, what in our head, we were like, well, we're doing this for God,
and yeah.
don't get in the way. It doesn't care. I don't care who you are.
Right.
Yeah. Context, just because you don't know, Josh and I were in a cult together.
Holy shit, really?
We were, yeah, no lie. And so, not to make a, you know, maybe crass comparison between your experience or what you're talking about, yeah. Because some of those people sound like great people, and the environment that we were in became pretty abusive and terrible. Sure. However, there is a certain type of personality and a certain type of longing for belonging and for meaning, yeah. That really, really like allows you to just kind of like soak in and sink in and mesh yourself in to that environment and become whoever you need to become, kind of to continue to experience that. And so I can relate to that feeling, yeah. And that emotion that you're talking about that drives you. And so much of it is good, right? It's like, I found this belonging and I'm being embraced for everything that I am. But it sometimes, you know, at some point feels like trading some of yourself because you're becoming more a part of this thing than you are asserting who you actually are.
100%.
I can relate.
Yeah, we can for sure. And Cortland and I, we had a very terrible toxic person who was leading this for us, you know, and manipulating the whole situation. But
but that's not what this episode is about.
I would love to hear about that sometime though.
Yeah, we could talk about it for sure. Definitely on another app. But, you know, so you're in this environment. I'm kind of curious how much you associated these feelings and these things to religious or spiritual motivations, right? Like when you talk about being, you know, a John Eldridge, wild at heart, how much of it was about being godly or pure or righteous? Like for you, was it religiously motivated or was it more cultural?
I think it was, I think that's a chicken or the egg question.
Oh, okay.
you know? Like, I'm not quite sure. Because, like, I mean, really and truly, if I look back in my life when I was the most on fire, again, for the listener at home, I'm using air quotes, on fire for the Lord, it was that window of time. Like, I was utterly devoted to the faith, and, like, I carried my Bible around my senior year of high school in my backpack, and I witnessed my biology teacher. We actually had some really great conversations. I would love to reach out to her. I don't know where she is these days, but she was agnostic, and, you know, we had some good conversations. I feel like she and I would vibe now.
Yeah, I have that experience with people that I had witnessed to in the past, for sure, where I've met them afterwards and I'd be like, oh man, yeah, okay. We've both had more experiences since then, but I'm grateful that somebody talked to me and didn't write me off.
For sure. But yeah, so I do think that it was utter devotion to the faith, and the fact that that devotion was rewarded by the community that I so wanted to be fully belonging to. I think the two were informing each other, and it really only started tumbling, I would say, when my relationship with the camp community started to unspool a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. And that's when you began to maybe question some of those religious norms or societal norms or these things, these values that you held in high regard. What was that? What was that process like?
So I had gone to college. I went to Wheaton out in Illinois. So famously, they like to call themselves the Harvard of evangelical schools.
Yep.
I don't really know if that's true, but we'll run with it.
I know other Wheaton folks who would like to claim that mantle.
Billy Graham went there, so good times. Also, Wes Craven went there.
No way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. A Nightmare on Elm Street. So I feel a kindred spirit with Wes Craven. But so I had started school at Wheaton College, and I had started my communication major, and I had a professor who was, she's a woman, like mid-40s at the time, and she had not married, no kids, and I took a gender and communication class with her, and that changed everything, literally everything. It was the first time where she wouldn't even really have to reach too far for examples of basically how sexism is real. She taught me this theory called standpoint theory of communication, which basically boils down to, in a society, you, like, the person who has the best view of what's really going on is the person who has the least power. And so,
interesting.
Yeah,
that's called standpoint view.
That's called standpoint theory.
Yeah,
of communication. And it was fascinating to hear her describe that, because I had been of the mindset, and I mean, if you ever read Abandon All Hope, you will see that I embed this into one of my characters, that I had felt like white men were not being celebrated. Like, we have Black History Month, and we have Pride Month, and we have women's studies as a major. Where are the white men? Why are we not celebrating white men?
Where are the white men? It's like, oh man. Yeah. Okay.
I cringe when I think about that, but it was important that I unlearned thinking that.
Yeah.
Because standpoint theory teaches us that essentially every month is white History Month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, every day is International Men's Day.
Yeah.
Like, privilege is a very real thing. And, like, I had sort of thought that sexism at the time, I had thought was only just like this cartoonish, like, go make me a sandwich.
Yeah, like, yeah.
That's where sexism began and ended.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Right.
But it took that class sophomore fall seeing that, oh, sexism is not just that. It's a whole lot of other things and a whole lot of assumptions that are just kind of baked in being a person in society that you end up thinking. And so it was that class that kind of, like, if you look at an old sweater and you see the thread, I was like, yep. I started picking at it. So I was like, this professor's experiences sound very real and very shitty. Although I probably said crappy because I didn't curse at the time. But I start pulling at the thread, and then it started unraveling because I was like, oh, wait, it must really suck to be not white.
Yeah.
Oh, it must really suck to be not straight. Because again, I hadn't yet accepted that I wasn't straight. But it was like, these thoughts that I had started thinking as a result of standpoint theory and thinking about how the person with the least power has the most accurate view of how things really are, that rocked my world. And I returned to camp for another year, and I was just kind of over it that summer. And I mean, actually, I think I did my best work that summer on a camp level, just because I was like, well, I'm not in this for me anymore because this is not serving me. I'm just gonna do my job.
Yeah.
And I think the kids were better off for it.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Probably having someone who, you know, was beginning to be curious and question things is the best type of influence. You know, it's funny because I feel like oftentimes conservative mindset says that that type of influence is bad for kids.
Yeah. No.
I think that your story really illustrates how that type of influence is necessary for kids, at least from my perspective, to challenge some of these ideas that I think it's very easy for us, you know, in our younger minds to just accept our personal experience, whatever's right here in front of us, and not see outside of that.
For sure.
So I think that's fascinating. So you go back to camp, and then you go back to Wheaton. Where is the point where you begin to, I kind of love that Wheaton is what like kicked off your like existential crisis, so to speak.
You know, I mean, really, really and truly, I mean, we can rag on Wheaton all night long, but I really had a fine experience.
Yeah.
And I mean, I probably owe some of that to the fact that I didn't come out while I was there, but, you know, I made some great friends. I had some great teachers. I didn't have really any run-ins with the institution. So it was just kind of, I feel good about having gone there. Will I donate money to them? Talk to me when you affirm gay marriage or women preaching.
Yeah.
But yeah, so being done with camp that last year and heading back to Wheaton for junior year, I kind of hit a reset button because, like, alongside all of this that I haven't really talked too much about, I mean, I was going through some mental health stuff just because I was so tangled up in this John Eldridge, wild at heart image of myself. I had kind of devoted all this energy to creating this picture of the idealized Peter Fenton. And it had gotten to the point where I didn't really know who I was anymore. Mm-hmm. And that last summer at camp, I was like, well, this was what I had been basing my entire identity around. And now I don't feel like I belong here. So what do I do? So I went back to Wheaton for junior year, and I just kind of was like, I'm going to take things as they come. Like, I'm not going to go in with too many presuppositions and this list of who I am and who I am not. And I'm just going to vibe. Just going to be.
Yeah.
See what happens. See what comes naturally. And so in that time, I did a lot of my theological deconstruction that junior into senior year, which the following summer I did work for a missionary organization, but you know, whatever. Good yeah. Weekend student. Missionary while deconstructing, but whatever.
Yeah, well, it's like statistically, I know a lot of missionaries that are deconstructing, so that's not yeah. actually too wild. I think Phil Drysdale talks about how like over half of the people he talks to are in full-time ministry or pastors or missionaries or something. Because yeah. typically the people who begin to go, what the fuck is this, are the people mm-hmm. who are in it every day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, many of my friends who were kind of casual church attenders are still attending church and kind of casually Christian. Yeah. It is most of my friends that like we've had on the podcast, Calvin Arsenia, like he was like leading Club 121 at high school yeah. and, you know, working at summer camp, you know, church camp, and then went to be a missionary after high school. That was like, what the fuck is this? Because when you're yeah. in it, you're constantly forced to ask the question, is this legit? What is yeah. what, and what do I really feel about it? So I don't think that's mm-hmm. that's abnormal.
Sure. It was more so the willingly signing up for a missionary organization internship when I knew I was a year into deconstructing. Yeah. That's yeah. more the what am I doing?
Yeah. But yeah.
hey, I mean, I wanted to go to Europe. So
there you go. There you
Dude,
go.
No judgment here. Cannot blame yeah. you. I mean, I'm a full-fledged atheist, and someone's like, you want to go to Europe and tell people about Jesus? I'm like, yeah, I could do that. I'm yeah. like, sure.
Yeah. And so I mean, landing somewhere. As I was going through junior year was probably my best year of college, just vibing, seeing how things went. And I made a lot of wonderful discoveries about myself, none of which had anything to do with my sexuality, just like about what I liked and what I didn't like. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I can just like this. I don't have to, there's no can and can't in what I'm allowed to like. I can like being in an a cappella men's choir. That's yeah. great. I love that.
Yeah.
It was a good time. The Wheaton College Men's Glee Club. excellent experience. Like, that was unequivocally, unproblematically the best thing I did at college. Yes.
Nice.
Yeah. And I was just like, I don't know. There's something so freeing about being free from that like list of the John Eldridge list of yeah. like what you are and aren't allowed to do as a guy. I'm sure John Eldridge is lovely. I've never met him, but he's become my ideological punching bag,
which is fine. I think that it's, you know, like, yeah, no shade at John Eldridge, but like, I think it's a culture that definitely was very prevalent in my upbringing.
Yeah.
I mean,
Christians.
Yes. I mean, I sat through so many sermon series that were Braveheart or, I mean, God damn it. I went through a Godfather. It was like, you got to be a gangster type of like, man.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I mean, yeah, I mean, like, I kid you not, it was a 12-week series. I mean, there was this idea that this like tough, strong warrior man personality, which yeah. is like, if you actually look at the character of Jesus, doesn't make any fucking sense.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah. So yes, I like that culture was very, very predominant in my upbringing as well.
Yeah.
and I can relate to these ideas of letting go of expectation and just being able to like something. And it did seem like, even if it wasn't like very overt, it was definitely clearly defined that this is not kind of an allowable thing to like.
Yeah, exactly. Like, biblical men don't like this.
Yeah.
Biblical men like football.
And cigars.
And cigars. And pipes.
Pipes. Yes. Gosh. Yes.
Yeah. And so it actually was like into senior year that I started like coming to terms with my sexuality. Which was like, mind you, a year after I reset. Like, I think a lot of people will look at my story and say, oh, well, he decided he was gay and then moved away from all of this. It's not really how it worked. It was, I let go. I let go and let God, if you will. Yeah. and so I realized that I had fallen in love with my best friend. And being that I had one semester left at Wheaton, decided to sit on it. Just kind of like put a pin in it and said, we'll come back to this. And so, I mean, my experience at Wheaton really was fine.
Yeah.
It was fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was not out. I mean, I think we would be telling a different story if I were out on campus from the years 2013 to 2017, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, since then, it's been a little bit of a rocky ride in the coming out process. And just like some of these lifelong friends, air quotes, from camp turned out to not be so lifelong. Turns out it was not exactly the place where my weirdness was celebrated. And that's been hard. Like, it's hard to be looked at in the eyes by someone who you have been very close with, mm-hmm. who tells you that you're going to hell. Mm-hmm. Like, and I mean, there was a month of my life, April 2018, for those of you keeping track at home, where I had started coming out to friends and family, and it was not going over so well with mm-hmm. those camp people. And it was always cloaked in this, like, I'm only saying this because I love you, which mm-hmm. like just added the layer of like,
yeah,
insidiousness.
It's like the extra twist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, it would almost be worse if you just said, fuck you.
Yeah.
Versus I love you. And also
your essence
of who you are is going to cause you to burn for eternity.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's like, you were never really a Christian at all. It's like, I never said I wasn't a Christian.
Yeah.
I still am a Christian.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. But yeah. And they also see you as somebody who can't give back to what they're doing.
Right.
Anyway.
Or just somebody who can't, like, who clearly has not thought about this.
Yeah.
They're raising it with me like it's the first time I've ever heard these six verses in the Bible. It's
like, Peter, have you read Romans? I just I mean, we're here like on the podcast.
Oh,
have
yeah,
you
of course.
Have you read?
At one point, sure.
I do love that people are like, but there is this Bible verse. It's like, you don't think that's the first thing I fucking looked at?
Yeah.
Sorry, I get a little feisty.
I love, there's a Rachel Held Evans quote I just read Inspired. And she said, Jews tend to point to scripture to start a conversation, but Christians point to scripture to end the conversation. I was like, yeah, that checks out.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. That feels right.
Yeah. God said it. I believe it. That settles it. The line in my book.
So I'm curious, you know, if, you know, you begin this process of coming out.
Yeah.
Did you find spaces early on that were affirming in terms of finding Christian spaces or spaces for you to exist as someone who was a gay person of faith? Mm-hmm. Did you know of those spaces before you came out? I'm curious about how that process Sure. worked for you.
So I've had a very dear friend from Wheaton who, she's a lesbian. She came out to me before I had come out to myself. And like, so I've known of her as a queer Christian. And like, I've sort of on the periphery seen her be involved with Q Christian Fellowship. Just like scrolling through on Instagram and Facebook and like saying, oh, there's a gay Christians conference. Good for them. Because of course at the time didn't know.
Yeah.
So once I came out, she was actually the very first person that I ended up coming out to. So fun little parallels.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, she's great. And I think just in general, the queers tend to sniff each other out. So
yeah.
I think there's a reason we were friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was a reason we stayed friends, you know. But so she got me referred to Q Christian. And that's been a wonderful resource. I've met so many amazing people online and in person in Fort Lauderdale. They had a conference right before the world shut down. So glad I got that trip in.
Yeah.
In January 2020. In hindsight, that was wonderful that happened. But yeah, so I got involved with Q Christian Fellowship. But other than that, like I knew individuals who were affirming, like who were affirming in spite of what their organization stood for. Mm. I didn't really know too many affirming Christian organizations other than Q Christian, which was off on the internet somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my first job out of college, I was working as a boarding school advisor for a Christian high school, it was a wonderful job. I really liked it. And my boss was super affirming. Like I came out to her because I had developed a friendship with her and she was just really wonderful. So shout out to Lachelle. She's great.
Woo, go Lachelle.
Yeah. And so she was like, so she and I were talking about what I should do about it. Cause like the students didn't know. And I wasn't so much worried about the students. Cause like they were high school, they're Gen Z. Most of them were queer anyway.
Yeah. yeah.
But my concern was if word got out to parents, that right. would call for my head on a spike,
right.
you know, mm-hmm. that yeah. is a very real fear when you work for a Christian organization while queer. Yeah. And so we decided that I wouldn't re-up my contract and that I would leave on my own terms. So I would just wait out the rest of the year, start looking for new jobs and figure it out. So I did. I moved to Center City, Philly, and I got a job working in customer service at a theater. So that was a good job, but working in the Philadelphia theater scene was a very queer experience.
Yeah.
It was very, very not religious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like people had very sharp views on religion and what religion has done to them. I was like, well, I mean, I can't not be a Christian. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that's just in my experience with my life. I mean, I can't just stop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I tried. Yeah. I tried. But it was just like one of those things where ultimately I value the teachings of Jesus. and I believe in a higher power.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, like,
what are you going to do?
I'm a Christian.
What are you going to do? You're in whether you want to be or not, you know?
Yeah. And so I did end up getting plugged in with, so I'm sure you guys know about Church Clarity, right?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah. It's the online database of figuring out whether a church thinks you're a human or not. It's great.
Yep. Absolutely.
So I plugged in Philly and I found this wonderful PCUSA church, Beacon. Shout out to Beacon. And that was where I plugged in there as my local congregation. And even after moving out of the city, I mean, that's still my church. So I attend virtually on Zoom every Sunday. But hopefully once the weather's nice and now that I am vaccinated, I will be able to go back in person at some point.
Nice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That's incredible. All right. So let's get in a little bit to how this whole story, because we've got a lot of your story.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your book and about your art.
Okay.
Definitely. And because
I'm very curious. The story is fascinating to me. And would you give us a little teaser? Or Josh, do you have something specific?
Yeah, just like when did you decide that you were like, I'm going to be a writer?
So, I mean, this is a whole nother 45-minute story. So let me just try to condense it as best we can.
That's fine. And we can go as long as you want. I mean,
we're pushing one
in the morning for you, but
I have nowhere to be, guys. I can talk forever. I was in the middle school play, which again, you know, it checks out. I was in the middle school play and I was one of the leading roles and I had the script in my hands and in the middle of practice, I said, this script is bad. I can write better than this. Luckily,
the script is garbage.
I was an arrogant 14-year-old white boy, you know?
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Mrs. Fisher, shouts out to Mrs. Fisher, said, okay, write me a better play.
Wow.
And so, I mean, we still did the play that we had contractually signed on to.
Yeah.
But that summer, in between 8th and 9th grade, damn it, I wrote a play. And I handed it off to Mrs. Fisher, and she said, I love this. Can I produce it?
Oh, that's awesome.
And I said, obviously.
Yeah.
So here I was, 9th grade, and the 7th and 8th graders were performing a play that I had written.
Wow.
Which was, whoa, first of all.
Yeah.
And then... Well, then I took that hard right into evangelicalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't really write anything new until junior, senior year at Wheaton when I was just vibing. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, I liked writing that play that one time. Can I write something else? And so then I wrote my second play. And I wrote to the listener at home, I have all of the major things I've written framed on my wall.
Yeah,
on the wall.
Yeah. So I wrote my second play and then I wrote my first screenplay junior year. And then, I just kept writing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
The fact that you've written so much and that you've been creating, and I feel like to some extent it's been a, you know, your book that you sent over to us that I'm really excited to read is The Abandon All Hope. I feel like you are putting yourself and your story and processing through you on the page, which makes it's fiction. It's these characters, but it's you. And it makes me really interested to read it because I don't really like fiction that much, to be honest. Yeah. However, like there is something that's extremely personal about this writing and it feels like it has a point. And I connect with it in a way. And I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that book and kind of tell people about it and get their curiosity piqued.
Well, I am so glad you say that it feels like my own story, even just reading the media kit that I had provided you guys. The media kit is available on my website at bypeterfenton.com. So if you want to read through this document that we're talking about.
And we're going to plug it at the end again, and then I'm going to put it in the show notes, and then I'm going to tweet about it. And
great.
We're going to hype it.
So Abandon All Hope really is just, I felt a little young for a memoir because, you know, I am 25 years old. It feels a little arrogant to write a memoir when you're 25, unless you're Rachel Held Evans and you can do whatever you want.
Whatever you want. Yeah, absolutely.
I think her first memoir came out when she was 27, and more power to her. Yep. Rest in peace.
Yep.
But where was I going? Oh, right. So Abandon All Hope I felt a little young for a memoir, so I wrote Abandon All Hope. Abandon All Hope is largely a way that I've been processing my story. So if you made it this far in the podcast and you want to see sort of how I've processed through different aspects of my journey, that's what Abandon All Hope is about. It's fiction, but it is fiction in the sense that, like, the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I teach spiritual lessons that I've learned along the way through irony and humor in the text. And so that's where we're at with Abandon All Hope.
Yeah.
So what's the story? Well, the story is actually really simple. So three college freshmen. So one of them is a scrappy feminist. One is a naive evangelical. And one is a cocky logistician. They've all died and they're in hell. And hell has taken the form of a dorm room that's set up for two people. So it's three people, two guys, one girl, trapped in a dorm room.
Set up for two forever. People.
Set up for two people.
Such a relatable hell concept.
Yeah. And they are being tortured by a demon who's taken the form of a fun wine mom. Like, and she's aware that, you know, this is the form she's taken. That would be most annoying to all three of them. And she challenges them to a game. And the winner of the game, she's hidden her talisman somewhere in the room. And the person who finds her talisman and presents it to her will go to heaven. But the other two will be locked in the room for the rest of eternity, being tortured forever with the magic that she uses from this talisman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story.
There you go.
I don't know. It just is so good. And I love that there is humor. I love that there is so many relatable aspects to it. And again, I love that it is written in this very thematic way, because you're a screenwriter, mm-hmm. because you're a playwright, it is, from what I've been able to read so far, it pulls you in like you are reading a play or watching a film, you know, like there Good. Is yeah. an attachment to the characters that I think is really cool and interesting. And so, yeah, I'm really stoked and excited to not only read it, but hopefully share it with a lot of people. I kind of want to ask you a little bit about, like, just personally, I guess, selfishly,
sure.
because I've also gone through my own kind of like experience of like, I'm still in a process. I relate a lot to what you talked about earlier, and you mentioned how there is kind of this maybe outside idea that you were like, well, you just, you know, wanted to be gay or whatever, and so you deconstructed because of that. But you, mm-hmm. that wasn't the case, right? You deconstructed no. towards discovering yourself, right?
Yeah.
And then that is what then brought that to light was you finally getting honest with yourself. And I feel like I've gone through that process. I'm still going through that process personally. Yeah. So I think that there is other people who are listening, maybe who are in my position. I guess if you could talk to an earlier version of yourself that hadn't gotten there yet, what are a couple things that you would suggest in terms of allowing or letting go of some of these things that you put on yourself? What is some advice that you could give somebody who is trying to find out who they are? Because I think that's a big part of your journey, is like trying to let go of all these things and really discover who you genuinely are as a person. That's what I'm going through. And I feel like that's maybe what some other people are going through as well.
Well, that's a great question. Would love to know someone who knows the answer.
Maybe it was too big of a question, but I feel like you would have some insight.
I'm thinking about it and trying to phrase what I would say. Because I mean, speaking to 17, 18, 19 year old Peter, I mean, it's my book, but I think I would say reality does not have to be that complicated. Like, you shouldn't have to twist the things that happen to you to fit your view, to fit the version of reality that you're comfortable with. Because eventually, it's the same principle that I apply to how I learned how to actually write a term paper. You don't start with your thesis and then find your supporting evidence. You find your supporting evidence and you gather life experience that informs your thesis. Because like eventually a thesis will take shape when you do research and when you get out there and you see what the facts say. Mm-hmm. And from there, form your view. And I think that so many of us who either grew up in strict evangelical homes or grew up in these communities, we have this like circle. Like, you're allowed to critically think as long as you find the answer in this circle. Go. Get rid of the fucking circle. Do your critical thinking and you'll find a thesis. It'll come together, but find your evidence. That's what I would say.
Boom. Yeah, that's so good. That's so good,
man.
And I really appreciate
philosopher
it.
Philosopher too.
Playwright, screenwriter, philosopher. Good grief, Peter.
Waiter.
Leave something for the rest of us. College graduate.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's really helpful. Honestly, for me personally, that's really helpful. And I think that I could relate to what you're saying in practice, and I can kind of think back and go like, okay, that is what I'm doing. But I don't know if I've ever really been able to vocalize it that specific way. There are things about me, and again, not to make it about me, hopefully not. I just like, I relate with what you're saying personally. Yeah. It's like, I mean, you kind of joked as like, oh, there were these signs early on. I was like, there are these things that I look back on my childhood and I'm like, I did not look at the evidence. You know, I didn't look at my experience necessarily because I let some goal of who I needed to be shape who I was becoming instead of who I actually was.
Yeah.
Fuck. Peter, you just fucked my life up, man, in a good way. Right. So
it was my goal. I mean, I sent that Instagram DM thinking I'm going to ruin Cortland Coffee's life.
Yeah. In the best way. Best way. That's so good. So we are like right at time. We try to keep to an hour. Do you have more things that you want to specifically share? We can definitely go a little longer. Like I said, we have time, but I also, you know, listeners do tend to dive at around an hour and 20 minutes.
I mean, we can talk more specifically about Abandon All Hope. Yeah, I mean, if you have more questions about that, I can answer them. But
I think what I would love to have you do is kind of pitch the places where people can connect with you.
Sure.
Pitch the places where people can get the book. And then, you know, I would love to maybe do a part two at some point, maybe in season two, once I've read it.
Sure.
And that way I can ask more educated, specific questions about it, because I'm sure I will have those.
And what are the plans for producing?
So where can people find me? I guess is the important question here.
Yeah.
So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Peter Fent. So just start typing my name, but stop.
And then stop. It's perfect.
Yeah. And you'll see my headshot in a smoldery grayscale on both of those. So you'll know you found me when you see the grayscale smolder headshot. Nice.
Yeah. It's a thirst trap for sure.
For sure. And I do have an author website. You can find me at bypeterfenton.com. So that's bypeterfenton.com. So you can look me up over there. To get a copy of Abandon All Hope, you can find it on Amazon and on bookshop.org. Bookshop.org is a great alternative to Amazon if you don't want to continue lining Jeff Bezos's pockets. Yep. And bookshop.org will donate proceeds to local bookshops. So it's a great way to pick up Abandon All Hope. It is a little more expensive there, but it's for a good cause. So
yep. I will, even though I have a digital copy, I will be buying a physical copy from bookshop.org.
Yeah.
And we also hyped them on if those of you who listen to the Levi Rogers episode, his book as well, I purchased through there. It's a great website and I recommend that you do that. Fuck Amazon. Anyway. Go
ahead. I mean, if Amazon's your go-to, no judgment.
Okay. Get it there too. That's fine.
Yeah. Barnes & Noble as well. You can also you can follow me on Goodreads as well. So we do have a page for Abandon All Hope there. So if you are reading the book, just tap the reading button on Abandon All Hope if you are on Goodreads. I love seeing that. I mean, as an author early in my career, because I am, reviews kind of mean everything. So like if you personally know somebody who's an author, anyone who's listening, any one of your friends who's written a book, if you've read that book, leave them a review.
Yeah.
It's so important. Secondhand endorsements are really, really important to authors. And especially if you liked the book, I mean, I would say if you didn't like it, don't review it. If you did like it, leave a review.
Yeah.
Let them know why you liked it. Let them know why someone else should read it. It's really important to continue building authors' profiles so that other publishers can find them and pick them up.
Yep. No, that's important information. And I think it is important for us to support artists of all kinds. I mean, art, I feel like in our culture oftentimes gets reduced down to this kind of like bottom denominator or whatever. It is not, you do not realize how much it takes to create art. And it is so crucial. Like that art, that book that you have written, Peter, will impact somebody's life and change the course of their future. That is, it just, when you create, you change lives, and there is just such an immense value associated with that. And so we really need to, like, I will be a loud advocate of supporting artists. Because we get so much free content and we get so used to just seeing free content or seeing cheap content and not realizing how much blood, sweat, and tears independent artists especially put into the work that they're making and how important it is. So,
amen. Anyway. Amen.
Preach, Corlin.
So, nice. Buy Peter Fenton's book and leave him a goddamn review. There we go. That's how we'll end it. Really appreciate you being on the show today, Peter, and we will have to do a part two at some point, and I'm really excited.
Awesome. Thanks, Peter.
To stay Instagram and Twitter friends and hopefully connect about a lot of things in the future.
Of course. I thank you so much for having me. This was a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you for being here. We'll catch you soon on part two.
All right. Sounds good, guys.
That was it.
And we're back.
We're back. Welcome back to the outro where we tell you a few things before we close out the show. I really want to do this. I want to continue to do this.
Oh.
Voice.
I like this.
Although, since you don't have headphones on, I am definitely hearing an echo on your side of recording.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Is it making
it could add a cool effect.
Does it make it more like intense for you?
So that was our interview with Peter Fenton. Again, huge apologies to Peter and to everyone for having this episode out late. And thank you all the listeners and Peter for having grace and understanding for us as we try to stay up on schedule. Even moving to the every 2 weeks or every other week schedule, it does get tough as things get busier here in the summer. So we do have, most of our interviews for the rest of the season recorded. If Josh and I can get a solid day to record all of our other little parts to these, we should be able to get them out on a timely schedule moving forward. But really appreciate everyone's feedback. The feedback that we've gotten over the last, several weeks has been just really good. I know our listenership is going up, and that is thanks to you all who are sharing. Before I get into the spiel about sharing, following, that sort of thing, I did want to just mention again to go and buy Peter's book. Go leave it a review once you have given it a read, and follow Peter Fenton everywhere that we mention in the show and is written in the show notes on Twitter and Instagram, etc., so that you can keep up with what he is doing. Also, follow us. Follow Thereafter Podcast on Twitter. You can follow Thereafter Pod on Twitter. And if you want more consistent tweets, I am more consistently tweeting. So mine is at Cortland Coffee. That's no U, just CORTLAND, COFFEY. We should probably put that stuff in the show notes too. I never do that.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
It is a good idea. We're going to do that this time. So follow me on Twitter. We are on Instagram, Thereafter Podcast, and we're still working on getting a website up. It exists and just has a splash screen that said the website is coming. So I am going to get that. But we do, since we have that domain now, we do have an email. So if you want to send us an email, that's a great way to send us some feedback. If you have questions, ideas for the show, ideas for guests, or other things that you'd like to hear on the show, please send it over to hosts, H-O-S-T-S, at thereafterpod.com. And also just like and subscribe, follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Podcatcher, all of those places. I mean, do it in all of them, if you got Apple Podcasts and Spotify, why not just hit both places? That way you're guaranteed not to miss an episode, especially if we get in another place where we're a little off schedule. And that way, as soon as the episodes come out on whatever platform you use most. And lastly, reviews. We have gotten some new reviews on the iTunes Apple Podcast page, and that is just a really, really good way to help get more eyeballs on the show. The more reviews we get,
earballs.
I think that was TM Thereafter Podcast. Earballs. definitely leave us a quick review and a rate, however many stars you think this hour and a half or so of your life has been worth. Go ahead and drop that in Apple Podcasts. Josh, anything else for folks before we go ahead and close things out?
Guys, happy summer, you know, like...
Happy summer.
It's getting warmer in places. It's raining in places. It's not raining in other places, but you know.
Yep.
It's a beautiful day every day.
Enjoy the summer. And for the parents out there who are now with their kids 24/7, I am sorry. And I
look for as many camps, day camps as you can find.
Exactly.
That's what I'm doing.
Our prayers will be with you. We're excited. Hopefully you can enjoy the summer and we come back into the fall, you know, as vaccinated as a society as possible so that we can just keep things running as normal as possible. We're so glad to be in situations where we can actually hang out with other people. And if we get an opportunity to be able to connect with some of you guys in person at some time this year, that would be awesome. So keep listening, follow, subscribe. And that is it for us, Josh and Cortland, signing off. We will catch you on our next episode in the thereafter.